Hi, I'm Mike Collins. We'll get to the Charlotte Talks podcast in just a few seconds. But first, I want to remind you, it's WFAE's membership campaign, and you're listening to the show free from fundraising breaks. Think about all the in-depth, informative, and entertaining conversations you get from Charlotte Talks. And then maybe consider making a financial contribution in return. The amount is up to you, and we have thank you gifts at every donation level. Support us right now and get your own public radio nerd t-shirt, coffee mug, or sticker. More at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000 anytime. Thanks. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Cancel the caterer. The marriage is off between Charlotte's Atrium Health and Chapel Hill's UNC Healthcare. We're getting closer to the sale of the Carolina Panthers, and folks are speculating about just who the new owner might be. North Carolina teachers share their thoughts on packing heat in the classroom while students here prepare for the national school walkout in support of the 17 people killed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High in Florida. Local business owners chime in on President Trump's call for steel and aluminum tariffs. And although Charlotte wants to host the 2020 Republican National Convention, we may have already been eliminated from the competition. Our roundtable of reporters has details on those and other stories this hour on our weekly local news roundup. Alex Olgan is WFAE's healthcare reporter, and she is here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nick Oxner is an investigative reporter for WBTV. Thank you for coming back.
Hello. Thank you for saying my name right.
You're welcome. And Oz Helms is education reporter for the Charlotte Observer.
Good morning.
And old what's-his-name is here. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you for joining us again this week. You hosted the program
earlier
this week.
Yes, good to be back.
Good job.
Thank you.
You can watch us this morning on Facebook Live. I had just picked out my wedding gift when I heard that Atrium Health and UNC Healthcare had called off their plan to form a joint operating company. Would it be accurate to say that this was a surprise? Did we see this coming, anybody?
Well, I don't know. When your intended changes its name and runs off with somebody else, that might be a hint that the wedding's not going to happen.
Are you referring to the Georgia Hospital?
I am, yeah. Okay.
Modern relationship.
Yeah, this was, you know,
yeah,
this
open marriage.
Carolina's Healthcare, when it went into the talks, it announced its engagement with the UNC system. And they were hoping to have this done, I think, by the end of 2017. That didn't happen. You had a lot of people asking questions and saying they weren't getting good answers.
I was trying to remember yesterday when we started talking about this.
August.
When
did
August.
August. They announced it.
Okay. Trying to close by December. Go ahead, Ian. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, it was dragging on. People were starting to go, maybe this is not working so well. And then Carolina's Healthcare announced one day that it was changing its name to Atrium. And then I think within hours said, and we are creating this merger with Navicent. So, I think it was probably not a total shock.
So why now? Why do they finally pull the plug now? Was there what was the reason for
The scrutiny became increasingly, increased a lot from on high, from the folks in Raleigh started having a lot of questions. And this merger—
Not the hospital people, but the board.
The people in charge, the people that oversee
the hospital,
UNC health system.
Right.
And both the board of governors, who've had questions for quite a while, but then, in fact, when they announced that the wedding was off, I was in the middle of working on a story about the fact that both Republican Treasurer Dale Falwell and Democrat Attorney General Josh Stein both had grave concerns, which, if you can get bipartisan agreement on anything out of Raleigh—
That's when you knew.
Yeah,
That's
you know that
you
there
knew.
Is a problem. And so there were a lot of questions from the Board of Governors, from our elected officials. There were people saying, hey, UNC Health, it's not your decision to make. There was talk that the Council of State, which has to approve the sale of state property, would actually need to approve this, which is far more approval than anyone anticipated. And I think it got increasingly bigger headache for Atrium Health than they said.
Well, and I think also just from the beginning, even before we got into the whole Navicent, by the way, that's just a bizarre name for a company. Even before we
got—
Well, that's true. Before we even got into that, there was this whole idea of it was a merger, but it wasn't a merger. There was going to be this separate board that ran it, and you had the collision of, I guess, service areas. You know, UNC not only has its state and educational aspect, but it's also got more rural hospitals, and so you just had this whole sort of clumsy structure. And remember, Atrium, the former Carolina's healthcare system, is decidedly bigger. So there was always going to be a fight about control. And I think that's what really unwound this.
That's what unwound it. Who was going to control this? And as I understand it, wasn't the guy who runs this thing in UNC, wasn't he going to be like the overseer of the board? and is it Gene Woods?
Gene Woods.
Who runs Atrium was going to be the CEO. And suddenly, who was going to control this company became a snag in the works. But if it's not a merger, why
it was a merger.
Well, right.
But it's just different wording. Yeah, but say, there would have been the same antitrust scrutiny if it was a joint operating company or an acquisition. You know, antitrust regulators don't necessarily care how they brand it.
Okay. No matter what synonym you use for merger, it was a merger, and they really don't like that word.
What if we just called it Navison?
So Blue Cross Blue Shield hated the idea. Dale Falwell, the state treasurer, hated the idea. Who else hated the idea? You just mentioned
Attorney General
Justine.
And Duke University law professor Barack Richman, a critic of in general of hospital mergers, said, "We dodged a bullet here. Is anyone other than Atrium disappointed that this fell through? And is Atrium disappointed that this fell through?"
We don't know. They haven't said anything. We've asked, or I've asked, and we've gotten nothing. We have nothing to say beyond our statement. So there's very little information. They talk about exploring these other partnerships, but very little details on what those would be.
I would imagine this, I don't know, and you've done more asking than I have, Alex, but I would imagine this is a setback for them. The whole point of this merger was to have even greater leverage in negotiating healthcare payments with insurance companies, which is why Blue Cross was against it. And we've seen a lot of scrutiny. There's the antitrust lawsuit that's, well, now two that have been filed against Atrium that accuse them of price fixing. When they gobble up UNC Health, you would just essentially control, I don't know, y'all may know better.
It was 90,000 employees and I think 60 hospitals.
It's just about every hospital in the state. I mean, you know. And so that gives them extreme leverage to be able to set the price that people have to pay for healthcare, like it or not.
And not only that, in terms of employee costs and equipment and supplies and all those things, clearly they were looking at this as a way to generate more revenue and to save money, or they wouldn't have done it.
So they're being squeezed on the backside by these antitrust lawsuits. They're going to have to give something up at some point.
So one of the goals, allegedly, of this merger was going to be the expansion and making healthcare greatly available in rural areas. And when they announced the decision not to go ahead with this, they still talked about wanting to be able to do some of that, Alex. What are they going to be able to do?
That's a great question. I've been asking those same questions, and I haven't gotten any answers. I did talk to Barack Richman, that same Duke professor you mentioned, and he said that depending on however some kind of partnership is structured in these rural areas, it could still face similar antitrust scrutiny.
And he's not a fan of hospital mergers because they generally result in rising consumer costs?
Exactly, and that's well borne out by lots of research all over the country. I mean, there's some research out in California that shows with consolidation, like surgeries in those markets are significantly more expensive.
Somebody, and I read this in the Charlotte Observer this morning, somebody's calling for the governor to ask for a moratorium not only on hospital mergers, but on hospitals gobbling up private doctor practices for a year while they study this.
I don't know how they're going to be able to do that.
Yeah, that seems like a near impossibility, but hey.
Good luck.
And that horse seems like it's sort of out of the barn, too.
Yeah, that seems like that started long ago.
So last week, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was last week, things move so fast now, Atrium announced layoffs. Will the cancellation of this merger have any impact on that? Or do we know?
Again,
we know nothing.
I've been asking. I've been trying to get some answers. I don't know. But they are trying to cut costs in a whole variety of ways, and that seems to be one of them.
And I read a report this morning about some doctors leaving the practice because they're changing the compensation model in a drastic way at Atrium. So they're leaving as well.
And it seems unlikely that this announcement would change any of that. I mean, Atrium's kind of been doing its Atrium thing for a while, and this has been about their efforts to get down their ratio of the percentage of their budget that's made up of staffing.
Right. Mm-hmm. And not only that, I mean, I think they haven't said, but they could counter it by saying that because the merger's not happening, they need to, you know, restructure their finances more than ever, so to speak, because they're not going to realize
this. And
savings.
This doesn't affect their intent to merge with Navisant, your favorite company.
It does not. It does not.
Here's the thing we should remember as we head into Sunshine Week, that Atrium is still subject to the North Carolina Public Records Act. They don't want to provide any public records ever. I once got a document out of them. But the fact that they act like a private company when really they're subject to public scrutiny and they're really not getting any and they refuse to give you any is a real problem.
That seemed to be a point of tension between the UNC system, which is much more governed like and behaves like a public body.
You mentioned Sunshine Week. There may be listeners who don't know what that is. Is that an official week, Sunshine
it
Week?
It is. It's coming up this coming week starting on Monday.
Only in North Carolina or is
across
it around
the country?
Country?
In fact, the museum is having a Sunshine Week kickoff panel as we speak.
And Sunshine Week's purpose is to?
Is to promote open government and open records laws and transparency. And
that's right up your alley, isn't it?
Amen.
Safe to say that many of us will have some things coming out next week related to that.
You'll have special Freedom of Information Act requests just for Sunshine Week.
Just for Nick.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Panthers because we're getting closer to knowing who the new owner may be. We're going to talk about armed teachers. The teachers, at least in North Carolina, have pretty much spoken about this, and we'll talk about that. And I think we'll also talk about red light cameras as we go along in this program. It's the Local News Roundup with Nick Oxner from WBTV, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Alex Olgan from WFAE News. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup with Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, our Alex Olgan from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV. I've worked really hard over the years to learn to say your name.
You finally did it,
that's
Mike.
Right. And Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal. The Carolina Panthers went in search of new ownership when we lost our playoff game. So it has been, what, about
2 months?
2 months. According to most sources, we're getting closer to finding a new owner. Some say the announcement could happen this month. That seems fast, is it?
That seems fast to me as well. It does seem like the conventional wisdom is that this will be voted on by the owners at their spring meeting at the end of May.
Right.
I don't know if we'll have the owner in place, that's what, 3 weeks from
now?
And
do they have the final say? In other words, is it like owning a co-op where you may find a buyer, but the people who are members of the board don't want that buyer in?
Yes, they do have the final say, although generally they defer to their fellow owner, in this case Jerry Richardson, who is selling. You know, the one, I guess, obvious point here is that both Jerry Richardson and the other owners want the highest price or the near highest price, because not only it obviously is his franchise, but it lifts the values of all the other teams. So we have several bidders that have been thrown out there. There's a South Carolina businessman, Ben Navarro. There's David Tepper, who's a hedge fund billionaire. I mentioned to you that's always a good description for a sports owner. He's an investor in the Pittsburgh Steelers. There was, I think WCNC reported this week, some interest from international buyers. So, and we also have the local group led by Felix Sabatis. So,
don't we have casino owners involved in this too? Frank and Lorenzo Fertitta?
They were mentioned, although I saw other reports that maybe the casino aspect would rule them out quickly. So I would be a little more doubtful on that one.
I know nothing about this, but that serious bidders will probably emerge this month. What constitutes a serious bidder, aside from somebody who can afford it?
Well, that's what constitutes a serious bidder. Someone who could buy the whole thing themselves. Remember, we're talking about 2.2 to 2.8 billion.
Is that likely to happen?
I don't think so, but I do think the NFL would rather, you know, the minimum is 30%, and you can have as many as 25 partners. The NFL wants fewer rather than more, so you could have somebody buy 50, 60%.
How much does Jerry Richardson own?
48%.
So somebody could come in and buy the 48%, and the other owners that are currently in place could stay, or
no,
the whole
it's
thing
a,
will change?
It's a whole sale. Not wholesale, but a wholesale.
So have we heard any more about the likelihood of African-American ownership? I know that's been something that's been discussed a lot.
Yeah, that has not – there's not been really any tangible response from the Panthers or the NFL. Remember, there was Reverend Barber, who is obviously from North Carolina. There was the Urban League, Bakari Sellers, who's a CNN analyst. So there's been some clamoring in the African-American community for that to be
Steph Curry.
Yeah, there were some celebrity names.
Yeah,
that floated,
Diddy has pretty much just disappeared. So if it's out there, it is very quiet right now. And remember, the people that are really serious about buying or all signing non-disclosure agreements, so they can't really say anything.
That's the point I was about to make, is do we really think the people that we've heard from proactively are the serious bidders in this case?
Well, they could be, but I, to your point, Nick, I think there are other serious bidders out there that we don't even know. So the eventual owner might not be someone we know until it's announced.
And Felix Sabatis has said that for him, at least, the offer will have to make business sense. It will not be an ego purchase, because you could go bankrupt doing that, essentially.
Well, have a nice day.
Yeah, so, I mean, as buyers or potential buyers emerge, do they know what the bid is? Will that start driving the price up?
I'm sure it will once they get into, you know, the Allen & Company, the investment firm that was hired by Jerry Richardson, is in charge of making sure that it does rise and that people know what the going rate is.
Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles was on this program yesterday. She mentioned again that keeping the Panthers here was her top economic development priority.
I think it's important to recognize the amount of state taxes that they pay, the amount of our tourism dollars that are achieved as a result of them being here. But even after that, Mike, I think about the character that they bring. I've been to Cam Newton's camp for kids. I've seen the work that Thomas Davis does. That kind of activity and endeavors by the team members are, you know, you can't measure that.
And I also asked how far the city and or the county might be willing to go to sweeten the pie. She was pretty vague on that, but she did say that there is a point in every deal where it no longer makes sense. What do you think the chances are of keeping the team? If a new person comes in and says, okay, I'll stay, build me a new stadium.
Then that's going to be a very complicated conversation, because the city doesn't have the money, even if it wanted to do that. And I don't think the city would ever just say.
Would the state kick in?
Well, Roy Cooper has made it clear that
Roy Cooper has. But here's the problem.
Republican legislature.
Roy Cooper's not in charge. Yeah. I mean, Roy Cooper said that.
He has some authority up to a point to kick in a lot of money. Here's a question that is probably we're not talking about enough, I think, is how much money should we spend to keep the Panthers here?
Well, that's a very good point, because no one has said politically. And remember, back when Jerry Richardson was at the height of his powers, really had a lot of clout, he went up to Raleigh several times and asked them for help. And everyone shook his hand and smiled and said, go Panthers, and said, by the way, you're getting nothing. So I don't know that it's a given that the state will pump in a lot of money.
It's maybe a little premature, but do you think that city and or county officials, or together a group of them, have gotten together to talk about what their options might be once this is announced? Have they put together, I don't know what, not an offer, but
I think there's some informal conversation going on, and I think Ron Kimball would be where you start. Ron Kimball, the former deputy city manager, he is the one who has structured a lot of these public-private deals. He's still a consultant to the city, and he has been pretty blunt in city meetings when he goes through the tourism revenue and what's available and what might be needed in the future. So I think that where this is going to start is when you get a new owner, the city is going to hope that they can convince that new owner to go along with some more stadium upgrades. And then it's going to get very complicated when the new stadium conversation
starts.
Well,
and wasn't one of the whole reasons why the city didn't want to pay for the MLS stadium, the Marcus Smith proposal to build the soccer stadium, was because they were squirreling away cash for the Panthers.
Yeah, they know that they have a big request coming to them.
Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned. We'll stay tuned. It is no secret that President Trump is an advocate of arming certain faculty and staff at schools as a way to thwart school shootings. Several figures in law enforcement have said that is a bad idea, and State Superintendent Mark Johnson is also opposed.
I firmly support the Bill of Rights, but when I was a teacher, I can tell you from my own experience of dealing with the challenges of the classroom, I would not have felt comfortable with the additional responsibility of carrying a firearm in my classroom.
And now there have been several polls of teachers. There's a poll conducted by Elon University, which shows that most North Carolina teachers agree with the state superintendent, Mark Johnson. 78% of teachers polled in that poll say this is a bad idea. Only 379 teachers took part in that survey, however. And when you consider, I was going to ask this morning, when you consider the sample size, how accurate could that be? But then, it turns out, the State Department of Public Education has also taken a survey of 22,000 teachers, and they respond that, well, 65% of them say they don't want to have a gun in a classroom. 25% said they would like to carry a gun. 10% not so sure about it. So can we say now with relative certainty that the majority of teachers in North Carolina want no part of this?
I think so. I mean, there is a significant minority that at least has some interest in this. And it did, as you might expect, the Elon one is the one that I've looked at in detail. That was done in conjunction with the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. And you did have, not surprisingly, Republican teachers were more likely to support the idea. But even then, it was, I think, 57% were saying that was a bad idea. And only 29% of them were willing to carry a gun, which is still, you know, a majority saying they didn't want to do that. Non-white teachers, which were, again, a pretty small chunk of that sampling, but they were extremely opposed to either carrying a gun themselves or having others carry guns. And the poll tried to break it down a little beyond just sort of the visceral reaction and asked them to think about a very specific plan in which only a few teachers who had prior security experience and were extensively trained and evaluated would be armed. It's, some people have called that the air marshal idea, that, you know, most of them won't have guns, but you never know who does. Still, 69% said that was a bad idea.
Well, last week on this program, we played that list of questions that NBC's Chuck Todd posed that as questions that need to be asked and answered by any school board considering doing this around the country. It's a long list. It lasts about a minute. You can go back and listen to our show from last week and get it. And one of the questions was, who is going to pay for guns being carried by teachers? And if it is the school systems, then wouldn't that give fuel to an argument against guns being made by teachers who say, hey, wait a minute, we need money for school supplies and books and pen and paper, and you're going to spend it on guns? Wouldn't that give fuel to that argument?
Yeah, and I think that becomes, I think the likelihood that school districts are going to go out and buy weapons for teachers is extraordinarily slim. I think that becomes much more of an issue when you talk about things that seem more reasonable.
So like, teachers would carry their own gun?
Well, again, I'm just saying I don't see this
happening.
This idea happening, but you do have things that are going to be very seriously discussed, like should there be more armed staff who are not teachers but who are armed security guards, or should you in some way have bulletproof places where students can get to, or should you put fences around all the schools? I mean, things that are viewed as much more reasonable are also very costly, and it's still going to become, is it that versus educational expenses?
That Elon survey uncovered a few other things, significantly stronger support of other school safety options other than having teachers carry guns. What were some of those things?
Universal background checks for gun sales, 99% supported that. More money for mental health, 92%. Enhanced training for emergency situations, 88%. 80% supported the federal government providing more money for school safety, but letting the local districts decide how to spend it. One of the more split ones was the question about should there be airport-style security screenings, and that would probably, again, have more to do with, you know, the student guns that come in that are more frequent than mass shootings. 50% were favorable on that, 22% were unfavorable, and 28% neutral. So there are some that have overwhelming support that are probably more about society, the schools. There's a lot of debate.
They also wanted to ban semi-automatic high-capacity rifles. They wanted to mandate two armed police at schools, and they want increased funding for mental health.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. A little bit smaller margins, but yeah, a lot of things on there. The one I found fascinating, they asked about the teacher's personal level of expertise or experience with guns. 36% described themselves as somewhat or highly skilled at using a handgun. 39% said they'd never fired a gun.
Mm. Next week is National Student Walkout Day. I think it's the 14th?
Yes,
is that
Wednesday.
Right? Students at several area high schools are participating in the walkout in support of the 17 people who were killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Lakeland, Florida, a couple of weeks ago, about a month ago now. These walkouts are being officially condoned, at least here in Charlotte, by CMS, correct?
CMS kind of left it up to the principals how to handle it. I would venture to say that most, if not all, high schools, at least, and that includes private and charter schools, are going to do something to acknowledge the concern.
Are there rules about what can be done, how long these marches will go on, where they have to take place, can they leave campus, et cetera?
Yeah, the last thing they want is what they saw last spring, where you had some of them get out of control, or you had students leave campus. So administrators and student leaders have been working together to plan ceremonies. There's also been a real emphasis on making it not overtly political or partisan. In other words, yeah, they might be encouraging you to write to your legislator, and Nick might be writing in favor of more gun control, and Eric might be writing in favor of, you know, more armed security guards, but the school is not going to take a stand behind any particular political solution.
Are these marches, or these walkouts, only taking place at the high school level, or are they taking place down the line?
That I'm not sure of. I haven't heard about it nearly as much at the lower levels, but I would not be surprised to hear some middle schools doing something.
And nationally, I'm told this is going to take place at 10 a.m., but that's not necessarily the case at CMS.
Well, again, you know, they've been trying to make it so it disrupts the school day as little as possible. Right. So if your class changes at 10:20, that's probably when they're going to do that activity.
Of course, this is a little outside our range, and we only have about 45 seconds left here. But in South Carolina, Greenville's Powdersville High School kind of is going back and forth on this. At first, they said you can march, but you cannot advocate for gun control. Then they realize that's a violation of the First Amendment in order to support the Second. So now they're saying you can't march, but you can talk about it in class. Is that essentially it?
Yes. And I think, again, those juggling acts are going on at a lot of schools. Some schools are not letting the kids walk out, but are having some sort of discussion or presentation.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you'll be talking about this next Friday.
I won't be here, but I will be covering the...
fine time
I'll
for you not to be
I'll be out there Wednesday seeing
right.
what's going on.
When we come back, we'll talk about steel tariff reaction locally here and the red light cameras that may or may not be making a comeback and other things, including our Republican National Convention bid. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup featuring Alex Olgan from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Nick Oxner from WBTV News. We were talking about guns in schools and the school walkouts next week before we took the break. As that debate continues, I should say, gun violence in North Carolina has reached a new high. And your colleague Ann Ames Alexander at the Observer reports that in 2016, which is the most recent year for which we have statistics, which strikes me as odd, more than 1,400 people died from guns in the state that year, more than any of the previous 35 years. I'm just curious, given computers, why don't we know? Why don't we have statistics from 2017 at least?
Well, we're 3 months into 2018, so you would need a full year's worth. And this is a national, anything that compiles data from all the states tends to be slow, any data source I've seen. So that doesn't, it surprises me that 2016 is just now landing. I don't know if it just arrived or if we just requested it. Maybe we thought we were going to get 2017.
So is there any research on what's driving this?
Well, the CDC is barred from researching public health effects of guns. What about locally? I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah, there was speculation. There was talk about maybe it's the opioid epidemic and the drug dealing and violence that's associated with that. There was talk about the fact that there's just more guns. Homicides rose in 2016. We expect that they will rise again in 2017. I was struck that gun suicides, actually accounted for well over half of those deaths, 788 of them.
Well, we keep being told now that this is a public health problem. It's not a gun problem. It's a public health problem. But if it's associated with guns, Alex, why is the CDC barred from studying it?
Because lawmakers barred them from doing that. And it's something called the Dickey Amendment years ago. But, you know,
who's behind that?
Well, I mean,
the NRA.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the one thing that is interesting, I did see that the American Public Health Association and their journal is now starting to publicly release some studies. And, you know, they range from a variety of different things. But one of them is studying effects of state laws on gun homicides and a whole variety of other things. But there's not all that much research, so it's hard to say.
And wasn't this also a rise percentage-wise? In other words, it's not just that the population of North Carolina is larger.
Right.
It's on a percentage basis as well that it's increasing.
Right. We had 14 gun deaths per 100,000 versus 12 nationwide. So we are killing ourselves and each other at a higher rate than most states.
So there's a new thing out of Washington now. President Trump announced tariffs, 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum, and the several local people are involved in businesses that either manufacture this material or use it in the manufacturing of other material. Charlotte, the head of Charlotte Pipe and Foundry, excuse me, has come out in favor of this. John Ferriola, the CEO of Charlotte-based Nucor Steel, have come out in support of President Trump's suggested tariffs. And here's John Ferriola talking on CNBC.
Most countries in the world have a 25% or greater value-added tax on products going into their countries from the United States. So if we impose a 25% tariff, all we are doing is treating them exactly as they treat us. We're simply leveling the playing field.
Now, I know that value-added taxes are added on at the cash register in consumer purchases in places like France and Italy and places like, but are they adding value-added taxes on raw goods sold to manufacturers?
I don't know all the details okay. of that. I would be surprised, but I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, Ferriola has had the president's ear for a while. The former CEO of Nucor was an advisor right. to President Trump, so they've had his ear.
Both of these companies are involved in this directly, Charlotte Pipe and Nucor. Nucor was mentioned specifically, along with U.S. Steel and Century Aluminum, by the Wall Street Journal as among the, quote, short list of companies. And by that mean not, but they mean it is a short list of companies welcoming Trump's proposed tariffs. How short is that list? Does anybody know?
Well, we don't know exactly, but there are far fewer steel producers than companies that use steel or aluminum right. to make products.
You know who uses aluminum? People who make beverages, and some local brewers have expressed concerns because this tariff could raise the price of aluminum cans. Do local brewers put their beer in aluminum cans, or do they put them in bottles?
Well, yeah. One of the reports, one of the reports this week was about a North Carolina brewer who was talking about how he knew to the penny, what was it, 2.3 cents a can?
Right.
And so if it went up to whatever, 2.4, 2.5, that obviously makes a big difference. That's just basic business, despite the weird appearance by the Commerce Secretary with his can of Budweiser and his can of Campbell's soup.
What are we hearing from automobile manufacturers and airplane manufacturers about this tariff? Because they would really be
hit
by this.
Downstream producers in general are not happy, because what you have to remember is the price of steel is going up overall, not just imported steel. Domestic steel prices will go up too because of this.
Why?
Because they're not having to compete against the cheaper steel.
In fact, that's actually the point of the tariffs, is to boost the American
yes.
steel industry, which means higher prices for them. So.
But as many news outlets have pointed out, there are more people employed by the downstream people who use these products
but
are employed in the industries that make these products.
But there is – I think it's fair to say that President Trump has been very much enamored with sort of the raw power manufacturing that the steel industry, for one, represents. And so that is one of the reasons this is near and dear to his heart.
Despite the fact that it's just as blue-collar, the guy making the Campbell's soup can.
Right.
Yes. I think someone has failed to see the forest through the trees.
I mean, I talked to a CEO of InSteel Industries up in Mount Airy the other day, and they make steel wire that's used in construction. And he was saying, I don't understand why this is attractive to a president who says he supports manufacturing.
And let's remember, Canada and Mexico, for now, not yes. part of this. So
because
this
he will have to buy the guy that does rebar. He will have to mm-hmm. buy the steel to make the rebar, and that will increase his
exactly.
prices.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the return of red light cameras. These were very popular when they were here.
Unless you got a ticket from them, then they were less so.
I got one of those special letters.
I got one
era.
Too. Yeah.
Did you really?
Yes, I did.
Scofflaws. The return of red light cameras to Charlotte has come up again at City Council. Yesterday on this program, we spent a few minutes talking to Mayor Vi Lyles about that.
There is some discussion about whether they're effective, whether or not they cause rear collisions. So what I want to say clearly, my point is, it's one of the tools we ought to use. I'm not saying that I want red light cameras without knowing what it's going to accomplish. And what I've said to the city managers, tell us how it works. If it's effective, how could we do it? And if it's not effective, tell us what is so that we can make our city safer.
Well, the city manager, Marcus Jones, is not in favor of their return. So why is this coming up again?
One of the challenges with this is that the law says that when that hypothetical person gets that letter and writes the check, the money can't just go straight to the city. Most of it has to go to the school district. So I'm sure Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools would love to see them bring it back, but then the city is saying essentially this costs us money, yes. And it has to and be a decision right. about...
1998 to 2006, when we had these cameras, there was a company in Florida. Why is the company always in Florida? There was a company in Florida who put these cameras up and who managed the program. If they took a picture of you running a red light, they sent you the ticket, as I understand it. But the North Carolina Court of Appeals ruled that 90% of the revenue from red light cameras had to go to local school boards of education. Is that right? School boards of education, yes. And that made it cost prohibitive. We couldn't pay the company in Florida if we had to give the money to the schools. We stopped it.
Can we just back up a minute? Because I was at the council meeting on Monday night, and it truly was good comedy, because Greg Phipps, one of the council members, is talking about studying this issue, and all of a sudden Marcus Jones, the city manager, pipes up and says, oh, by the way, that's not happening. I'm against that. And sort of the whole room is like, wait a minute. I thought we're studying. So I don't think they're anywhere near on the same page yet, just in terms of whether this is going to move forward.
Even if they wanted to bring it back, how would they pay for it?
That's a good question. But I don't even think they know whether they are going to bring it back or can bring it back.
It's interesting because, you know, Marcus Jones came from Norfolk, where I was there when he was there, and we had red light cameras in Norfolk, and they caused him a lot of problems, and I did a couple stories on him. And so,
what kinds of problems?
There are questions about how do you appeal your ticket. There are questions on our police officers reviewing the tickets to make sure you violated the law. There are questions about companies that get the contracts. There's questions about overbilling. I mean, there is truly a lot to study, and it's actually refreshing to hear a city manager actually say, no, this is a bad idea.
Okay. Charlotte has a new city planner, too. After a long period of not having one, we went for years without having a permanent city planner, and he's working on rewriting our zoning laws in toto by June and toto, too, by June of 2020. But already, and despite many critics of the current zoning ordinances, city council members are asking for caution here. They're worried about confusion on their parts and on the parts of citizens. It's very, very complex. They don't understand it, and they say that if they don't understand it, how could they ever explain it to citizens? So are we short-circuiting this process before it even begins?
Well, I don't know if we're short-circuiting, but I will say this, by the time it ends, and assuming it ends on time, it will be a 7-year process. That is, you know.
But it's supposed to be done by 2020.
Right, but they started talking about this in 2013. They started talking about this in 2013. And part of the problem is they went almost 4 years without a planning director. Can you imagine any city, much less one that's growing like this? But we did that as a community. And so you have those problems. And then you have the separate issue, Mike, that you're talking about, which is that councils keep turning over and you keep having new members who don't understand. You know, they're not familiar with the complexities that you're talking about. And so that's what's creating.
Especially this council.
All this mush. Especially this council.
Yeah, you have a lot of new members.
A lot of new members, very politically inexperienced. So this is going to be a challenge for all involved, I think, would be the safest way to
We will have the new city planner on this program. I'll have to learn to pronounce his name. It's harder than Oxner.
And that took you 2 years.
That's right. So he'll be on this program on March 22nd. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which will bring natural gas through North Carolina to be used by Duke Energy, has its fans. It has its detractors. It has also given birth to a controversy surrounding the governor, Governor Cooper, a Democrat, and a request by State Senator Rabin, a Republican, for hearings to get answers from Cooper about an agreement he negotiated with the pipeline. I tried to read this yesterday, and my eyes closed.
So the agreement or the article?
No, the everything.
Well, at the same time as the governor, as the governor's administration through the Department of Environmental Quality announced that they had approved crucial permits for the pipeline, the same day the governor's office said, oh, hey, these same companies that are building the pipeline are going to contribute $58 million to an economic development fund. Without it, and that's about all they said. And then a couple days later, the governor's office came out and said, no, the General Assembly won't have any control over it. It'll be at the governor's discretion. And, of course, you can imagine what the reaction from legislative Republicans was to that. Right. So the questions persist about how that fund came to be, what its purpose is. Since then, the General Assembly has passed a law that says that money must be used for schools in the areas affected by the pipeline, and the fund continues.
So we all know that we have put our bid in to host the 2020 Republican National Convention, as we did in 2012 with the Democrats. But there was a story in Politico yesterday. They had this to say. Democrats are looking at Minneapolis, St. Louis, Phoenix, Milwaukee, New York, and Columbus in 2020. Republican early favorites include Phoenix, New York, Miami, and San Antonio.
Uh-oh.
Can we survive not being on another list?
Get me rewrite. I think that Amazon's in charge of picking the RNC site, so, you know, do with that what you will.
Quickly.
I don't know what to make of that, but the Republican bid is still going forward from Charlotte. That's what I know. So they are still going to bid.
That's Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Ann Doss Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer. Nick Oxner from WBTV News. And Alex Olgan from WFAE News. Thank you all again for the hour.